Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. And today we're going to talk about a movie that may have the secret to your jiu-jitsu development and your development in life as well. How you doing, Dan?
I'm good. I'd say solid 7 on a scale of 1 to 10.
That's a classic. Can never say that not enough. I love hearing that. Yeah.
It's been a while.
Let me ask you, I'm going to guess, Dimitri, what do you think? If I ask Dan what his favorite movie is, I have a strong feeling he's going to say, I don't have a favorite movie, whatever. I don't know. Do you have a favorite movie, Dan?
I do not have a favorite movie.
Okay.
I'm not sure you should have a favorite movie. That sounds okay. A little childish to me to have a number one. I guess you could, but that's like, to me, it's like, what's your favorite color? I'm like, I'm a grown man. I don't have a favorite color.
Be a man.
Yeah. Depends on your mood, right? Like, you're not going to.
I think it does.
Movies, but it's wrong to say I like them all the same. Like, I like some movies.
And they come and go. Like, you see a movie and you kind of like it, and it stays kind of like in the high on your list for a while, and then you move on, right?
Yeah. And you can have a movie that you think of as your favorite movie and you haven't seen in a while, and you watch it after a while, and then you think, oh, wow, this did not.
Dan, I had that exact experience lately. Yeah. It's so disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah, movies are funny that way. Like, how your expectations frame your enjoyment of the movie, right?
And you can have movies that it's your favorite movie because, you know, you used to watch it when you were a kid or whatever, and you're sort of like, it's maybe not objectively the best, but.
Right.
But I've had that dated one where I've sat all my kids down and they'll be like, let's all watch this because it's hilarious. And then halfway through, you're like squirming, like, this is not.
This isn't even
the kids
funny.
Are like looking at you like, what's your problem? And you're like, I thought it was funny.
Comedy goat. It decays quickly, right?
Yeah, it's hard to. Sometimes it's almost shocking. Like but it's almost shocking when it holds up. Like I watched, I watched Young Frankenstein with my kids, and they were like, "It's pretty funny."
Huh?
You know, like
I would not have guessed that.
Mel Brooks like is really dated. You know, like a lot of his stuff, but like Young Frankenstein, I wouldn't say it's like laugh out loud at this point, but like I was like, that was all right. Like I laughed a little bit.
I think the difference. In the 80s, like pre-90s, is that the things went at a much slower pace.
Yeah.
Like if you watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Steve Martin, John Candy, very funny movie, but it moves at a slower pace than like bam, bam, bam.
That was actually one where I was like, this is really good. And I watched with my kids.
Yeah.
And it ended and they were like, what was that?
They didn't like it.
No.
I think I watched it a couple years ago.
It was fine. You know, they were like, it's fine. But like... that was like this great movie from your youth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's how I remembered it. But then as I'm watching, I'm like, yeah, this is not.
It's pretty funny. There's some funny moments, right?
Yeah, but it's like you said, it's not. It's the kind of, you wait for them.
It's more character oriented than just gag oriented,
another
right?
Another dated one. Another Steve Martin dated one was Roxanne, or like Cyrano de Bergerac.
I only saw bits of that. Yeah. I couldn't get into it. The whole gigantic nose thing threw me off.
I watched with my kid. I'm like, Steve Martin, he was like the funniest guy.
I haven't seen a long time, but I did enjoy that movie.
Yeah.
I bet that still holds up.
We'll see. Yeah. I might have a bad feeling about,
They have that scene where the guys, the mystic, back in bowl. They want to put the spirit back in bowl. And I used to use that line in our kids' class when I wanted the kids to get against the wall. I'd go, back on the wall. And they had no idea what I was talking about.
I laughed a little at Three Amigos, like that one.
I didn't think that was that great. Anyways, I don't know. I think Chevy Chase is so overrated. But then again, National Lampoon's Christmas movie, and it's still pretty funny, actually, even though it's just.
And then there's the
crazy
ones that really date. Like I watched one of the Inspector Clouseau movies with my kids
from the 70s.
And there was one where.
Those are way slower than today, right?
First of all, slower, and then there's those scene where you go, uh-oh. And it was like something like, I'm going to be undercover as a Chinaman.
Oh,
and like
he's
like puts on like the Chinese makeup. Yikes. And you're like, uh-oh, this is not. And again, then the kids are glaring at you, and you're like, I forgot about this scene.
That scene, right. And most guys say, if you ask a guy what his favorite movie is, for a while, Braveheart was right up there, right? Most guys would say that. But I saw some of that not too long ago, and Mel Gibson is insane, right? Yeah. South Park does this. They used to make fun of him where he's a masochist. He likes being tortured. And then you watch these movies, and you're like, oh, my God. In every movie, his eyes are rolling and his tongue's out of his mouth. Ah! And he's getting tortured somehow. Yeah.
Like Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Lethal Weapon is stupid now. I haven't seen that
in decades, thank God. Yeah.
But, you know, Braveheart, well, Braveheart became one of those movies like Gladiator. Like, as a guy, you're not allowed to critique it. Like,
Like,
all guys are like, don't say anything.
Gladiator's pretty good.
Braveheart was always kind of stupid. The way I remember it. There's going to be people
There's
listeners right now like, how dare you?
I'd like to see where he comes in on the horse and cracks the guy over the head with the chain and the ball and chain, right?
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool scene. But that's all of 30 seconds of the movie. Yeah.
One thing I'm realizing, too, is like anything we say on the podcast, and like people, you know, if I say that, they'll be like, so you hate Braveheart? I'll be like, I didn't say I hated it. Like, people take the extreme for what
take
things
the
that we say.
But, well, anyways, I was thinking about this movie, Dan, that I used to really enjoy. I had not seen it in many years. It's from 1993, so it is a little dated. But it was on recently, so the movie's Groundhog Day. So on actual Groundhog Day, one of the channels had it 24 hours a day, just on a loop, again and again and again. And I remember decades ago having a conversation with a woman I work with that somehow came up, favorite movies, and I was like, I like Groundhog Day. And she was just shocked. She's like, Groundhog Day? That stupid, trivial movie? That's what you consider a great movie? And guess what what she considered a great movie was?
Porky's? No.
Top Gun.
No, what? That's so much worse.
Top Gun is terrible, right? So then she said, I thought all guys like Top Gun. And I had to explain to her, no.
What she's saying. It's like, say, you know, if you're like, just go straight guy movies, you'll say Braveheart, Gladiator, maybe Top Gun, you know? Like,
Dan, have you seen Top Gun?
I saw it
it's
at the
very
top.
Homoerotic. You know what I mean? It's like Tom Cruise and Daisy Dukes in a bare chest, like hugging other men a lot. There's a lot of that in there.
Also bad parts.
I never got that movie. Yeah, no.
I actually saw it in the theater.
Uh huh.
And I was like,
Yeah.
But then I was like, I learned quickly, I couldn't say that about Top Gun. Like, everyone loved it.
Oh, right.
Sort of like those other movies I said, like Dances with Wolves was another one. Like, if you come out like, at the time, you're like, I can't tell anyone I didn't like it.
Oh, right.
There's some now, like,
I haven't seen Dances with Wolves.
What's the one I just said, Get Out? Get Out, I was like, that is the stupidest movie. And then it became like, how dare you?
Mm.
I'm like, sorry, I thought it was bad.
Right.
So...
So I watched Groundhog Day this past February.
So let's remind everyone, this is all by way of saying that this movie can help you.
You know what? Yeah, so I watched it in 1993 when it came out.
Yeah.
I probably watched it a dozen times since then. And then when I started thinking about it just a couple weeks ago, and I thought that maybe it's obvious to you, but I thought there was a profound message in it that's really important for jiu-jitsu or anything in life. And it sort of dovetails with where my philosophy is today on training jiu-jitsu. And actually, I thought it was still funny. Like, Bill Murray is a pretty charismatic character, right?
Right.
He's a very funny guy. And he's just basically himself in almost every movie, right? Just this wisecracking guy, kind of, right? And I thought I understood the movie, but I hadn't thought about it deeply enough. I thought it was just like a romantic comedy, a rom-com. Kind of a guy's rom-com, though, right?
Right. A rom-com with like a clever premise,
right?
And sort of interesting, and makes you what would you do in those days? And then
the male character is the star; he's the focus more than the female, right?
Yeah. So what did you get from it?
Here's what I got. I'm going to walk you through it. So you're familiar with the movie; you've obviously seen it a couple of times. So the character, you know, he's living this sort of shallow existence, and he's a weatherman. I don't want to. We can't be bad mouthing weatherman here, right? Because we're going to get
our weathermen, the weathermen listeners. That's a huge contingent of our listening audience.
But if you think about being a weatherman, it's like you're kind of a celebrity, but
for what?
if you're not even a meteorologist, like you're reading the weather, it's like you don't really have a big skill set other than you somewhat look good on camera, I guess, or something. I don't know. So he's living this shallow existence. He can tell he doesn't respect being a weatherman. And he's just like, he ended up there in his life somehow. Maybe because he thought it would give him some cheap status. Maybe he could pick up women easier if he was like a local celebrity. And they go to Punxsutawney to do this spot where the groundhog's going to come out, and it's a big event there and a festival and everything. And he's super cynical, living in the shallow life. And then they get snowed in, and they have to stay there one more night. And when he wakes up, it's the same day all over again. And this is his curse. So it's like a fable,
right?
I guess you would call it, right? Kind of like a modern day fable. You know, but he's living in this like meaningless life, and then he finds himself stuck in this kind of twilight zone. So what does he do? He's like, well, I like this woman. I'm going to try to get her in bed. I'm going to try to trick her and manipulate her and get her in bed. And he like proceeds to get closer and closer
by learning more and more about her. And then when the day resets, he already comes in armed with knowledge about her.
Right. So he has all these failures. So in a way, he's like learning. So he tries something, it doesn't work, comes back the next day, and now he's more equipped to come up with a better answer.
Right.
And he starts to slowly win her over that way. And he learns about her, what she likes. She likes French poetry or something, and this type of thing. But it's ultimately, it's trickery. It's just pure manipulation, you know?
Right.
And then it sort of culminates with this montage, I don't know if you remember, where he gets her back to his room. He's like, he has her at the edge of his bed. And then he says something, and she slaps him in the face. And then it's a montage of, like, you know,
repeatedly
dozens of
slapped.
And so he can get her all the way to the edge of his bed, but he can't finish it. He can't close the deal, so to speak. And it's all manipulation. So then he just basically sort of gives up on everything, and because he's like, I can't control the outcome. I can't get what I want. And he becomes despondent. Oh, this is all going to be spoiler alerts. Anyways, we're ruining the movie for everybody.
If you haven't seen Groundhog Day by now, come on.
I know. That's literally almost 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So then he...
By the way, you still might sort of enjoy it, even if with the spoiler.
I think you can. Yeah, it's very funny. He's
because it's very rewatchable.
I think so. Yeah, because there's a lot of silly gags and everything. But eventually, Dan, he just becomes despondent. He's like, I'm trapped here. I have no power over my universe. I'm going to kill myself. So, you know, he does all these. He jumps off a building. I think he jumps in front of a...
Crashes his car.
Crashes his truck. He jumps in front of a bus or something, and he just keeps waking up again. So it's like the ultimate futility, the ultimate lack of control. He can't even kill himself. He just can't stop this thing from going on and on. And I think there's something about that where, you know, we can't control everything. We can't control the outcomes. And when we struggle too much to try to control them, it's just frustrating. You know, we're just going to be met with frustration. So I can totally empathize with that. So then he quits trying to kill himself. He quits trying to pick up, what was her name? Andie MacDowell, is that the actress? Yeah. And he just sort of, I don't even think he thinks deeply about it, but he sort of stumbles into self-development. He starts taking piano lessons, and then he, I don't know if they show him, he doesn't take sculpting lessons, but somehow he ends up being this amazing.
He makes a big ice sculptor.
Yeah, he can ice sculpt. He can.
I guess the assumption is he just had lots of days to work on it.
To figure it out for himself, even maybe.
And the idea was he's working on all these skills. He's working on developing himself. He's taking piano lessons. And I didn't even see it as, it wasn't a major plot point. Like, he also learn to ice sculpt, but it represented like he's doing these kinds of things.
The self-development.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he even becomes a better person because he's like this shallow, totally self-interested person. And then at the end he's repairing the flat tire for these elderly women who are driving in their car. And he's
like,
get
a cat out of a tree, or
there's a kid that falls out of a tree every day at some time, and he runs and he catches the kid every day so he doesn't break his leg or whatever.
And even that, the point, I think it's like, even though it's just going to happen again and again and again, he's like, I'm just going to do some good, right? I'm just going to catch this kid, even though he's going to fall every day.
Right.
At least the kid won't fall out of the tree, right? Like, I'm going to do something good, even though it's just going
to
happen again.
And if you think about it, Dan, to me, I've been thinking so much about self-development, self-esteem, and status. He's not doing it to be to gain status. He's not like catching the kid in the tree and then he's going to get his picture in the paper.
It's the ultimate example of it. It's going to be erased.
It's going to be erased. And even the kid he catches doesn't even say thank you. Yeah. He just runs off. He goes, you never say thank you. That's one of the funny lines. So he's not doing it to gain status. He's just doing it because he feels like doing it.
Right.
He feels like it's the right thing, which to me is the ultimate if that's where you're operating from. Like so much of life is transactional that way, right? I was listening to Lex Fridman was interviewing Michael Malice and Yaron Brook on his podcast. And those Michael Malice and Yaron Brook are big into Ayn Rand and objectivism. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah.
So they're basically of the idea that you should be self-interested all the time. But it's like some sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, Dan? Elevated self-interest. It's like you're not being horrible, but like even if you donate money to a charity, there's an exchange there.
Right.
And people hear about it and they think you're terrific.
And ultimately they're saying self-interest at society benefits the most when everyone in it is being self-interested.
Right. Did you ever watch Curb Your Enthusiasm much?
Yeah.
Remember the scene where Ted Danson, what's his name? Ted Danson. He anonymously makes some donation, but everybody knows he made it, and it drives him crazy.
Yeah.
But that's it. Like, nobody... Why would you make an anonymous donation, Dan, and not let anybody know?
I've done it.
What's going on there? I think you're doing it because it's like your internal audience. Like, you feel good about it.
Yeah, I feel like I should help, and then I'm also feel like I don't want people... thinking like, oh, look, he put his name on it. So, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So you're not looking for status. That's my point.
Yeah.
You're not posting about it on Facebook or Instagram or something like this. I think when we chase status, it's not good for us. You know, we can get out of hand by sort of chasing status.
And that said, because I can see this, what I'm saying about our audience being like, sometimes I put my name on donations too, because sometimes I actually think it helps. It's like,
it does help.
You're like, you're like, hey, look, I'm donating to this, and then like I'll donate.
Could be a recommendation. Oh, yeah. If Dan Robin thinks this is good, I should take a look at it.
Yeah, or something like that. Or like someone from my high school wanted something, I donate to that, and then it's like, oh, so other friends from high school will be like, oh, maybe I'll take a look. You know,
kind of encouraging other donors. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, but at any rate, you know what the character I just realized? His name is Phil Connors. He has the same last name. Isn't that funny? So he's doing these good deeds really not for status, which is pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
And when he gets to that point in the movie where, then he tries to help the homeless guy. Remember the guy's getting sick and dying? Do you remember what happened with that?
I think he just got him, didn't he? I remember he got him like food and shelter or something like that.
I don't remember how. But so what happens is he can't save the guy. Like he sees the guy die, so then he's like, the next day I'm gonna get him a lunch with hot soup, and he keeps doing the things again and again and again, and I think he ends up giving up. It's like it's just that guy's day to die, and he can't stop it. So I think there's like a humility in that. Like, of course we want to try to do our best, but we can't control all the outcomes of what we're looking for. So what I realize is, and maybe it's obvious, but you know, he finally wins the girl and he finally breaks the curse, the spell, is when he's pure of heart, where he's just dedicated himself to development, where he's not gaming the system. He's not trying to win the girl over. He's not trying to bamboozle her and manipulate her. You know, I think there's another female character that he's involved with for a while too, but he just finds that it's too shallow.
She was shallow or slutty or whatever she was.
And he was too, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, and now you're reminding me of this, I think at one point there was criticism in the movie, and the way I also originally interpreted it was like, the whole goal is, once he gets to sleep with Andy McDowell, that's what breaks the curse.
Okay.
And they were like, what, that, you know, that's whatever it is, it's sexist, but to your point, that's not what the movie was about.
And that's actually not what happened. He didn't sleep with her.
Yeah, he didn't even sleep with her, right?
Right.
I think that's how, I think when I first saw it way back when, like in the theater, I thought that that's what happened.
Yeah.
Because I think she wakes up in the bed.
Yes.
And that's how you know it's... But it's not what happened, right?
It's not what happened. he commits himself purely to self-development, and then she becomes attracted to him. She sees him, and he's playing music. She's like, wow, I didn't know you were so talented. Oh, and then there's this series where they go, yes, he also fixed our tire, and then, oh, and he helped the mayor's back. Oh, like he gave the guy the Heimlich maneuver or something, and just like all these wonderful things that he's been doing come to light, and he's not trying to
win her over or even impress her, right?
He's not.
He's self-focused.
Right. Focused on his development purely and being a good person too and being a good citizen. And that's what wins her over. And even the poetry. So he first got into poetry to sort of like
trick her.
Like, I got this book of French poems back in my room. But at the end, I think he's not even reading French poetry. He's reading her like some other poetry. So he actually ends up appreciating the poetry itself. Yeah. And that's what breaks the spell, is like this pure of heart pursuit of his own self-development, making himself a better person, if you will. And I think that's profound. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
yeah,
I'm sort of still thinking through like applying to our listeners, right? To like jujitsu
because
a lot of points have been brought up already.
Yeah, I think it applies to jujitsu this way. You know, there's inherently a lot of status involved in jiu-jitsu, either with competition or with belts and ranking and things, you know. So if I'm going to training in order to get a stripe from my instructor, get a belt, even get praise from my instructor, it's totally natural, but it would be probably better if you could transcend that and just go there purely to develop.
Are you going through jiu-jitsu like the early Bill Murray, early in the movie?
Exactly,
or
right.
Bill Murray at the end of the movie.
Right.
That's really actually what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Like, are you going in there to try to manipulate the situation?
Look good,
impress. Bullshit people a little bit. Yeah, impress people somehow superficially to move ahead. Or are you going to truly develop yourself?
And with that self-focus, right, you're not, you're like, I'm, picture Bill Murray going to jiu-jitsu on Groundhog Day toward the end. It would be like, I'm just trying to get better. It's
just trying to get better.
The day's going to reset. It doesn't matter what happens in this class.
Right.
Wouldn't that be sort of the ideal way to approach the class of jiu-jitsu?
Like, I think so,
the day's just going to reset. So I'm just here to learn. It doesn't matter what anyone thinks about how I act in here.
I think so, Dan. Yeah.
So, with that caveat of, I'm also going to be a good citizen, so I'm also not going to be an asshole while I'm at it.
Right. I'm not some cold-blooded maniac. Yeah. I'm a good citizen, and I'm trying to develop myself. That's my sole focus. I'm not juggling that with, I'm also looking to get a little attention, raise my status a little bit. It's obviously not easy. It's not how we're wired as human beings. You know, status is very important to us. We're afraid to lose it, and we want to gain it. But I think it works against us a lot, especially in jiu-jitsu or in a lot of places, you know. I'm even thinking about that with competition, Dan. I have a couple of competitions coming up, so I'm working really hard for it, preparing, of course. But I'm wondering if I could just somehow truly fold competition into my own development, say, no, just another part of my development. I think what that would do for me is allow me to design my life so I'm doing the right amount of everything. So if I have a competition, I'm probably going to tend to lean into doing even more jiu-jitsu practice than I might not, which seems like, well, that's good. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it'd be better served right now if I dedicate a little time to something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just part of my day or something, you know? And why wouldn't I do that? I wouldn't do that because I'm afraid of getting a bad result at the tournament. So I'm going to, out of that fear, I might even overtrain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And overtrain, when I say that, I don't mean just to be afraid of injury. It's just, well, I'm not living my life maybe in the best way that I could, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I'm still trying to get my head around that, Dan. Because I was thinking, well, I have these two competitions. Maybe I'll take a break from competing just so I can catch my breath, look at my life, see how I'm spending my days, and maybe I want to change how I'm allocating my time. That's our limited resource or time. But I could do all of that and still keep competing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I wasn't afraid of some outcome. You know, I heard GSP was on the Lex Fridman podcast the other day, and this line came out as a throwaway, They didn't talk about it a lot, but I thought it was pretty important. They asked him, do you love winning or hate losing more? Which is stronger in you? And GSP said, well, I love winning much more than I hate losing. And that allows him to be competitive, to get out there and risk losing, which I thought...
I'm surprised. Usually, I think, when, like in if like psychological studies, they find that people hate losing much more than they like winning. Like, you know, and
I think
like,
most
like betting, losing $500 is much more painful than winning, than the happiness gained by.
I heard it described, it's twice as much. So we value loss twice as much as an equivalent gain.
Right. So it's good for him, but I would think it would apply to competition where the pain usually losing is worse than the joy of winning.
I think so, but if you can somehow get your head around it where it isn't, that would serve you.
Then mute both to some extent, right?
Where I think you have to do it.
Yeah.
I think if you celebrate and crow about your wins too much, you're just setting yourself up to feel bad and sad about losing, right?
Yeah. And that's why, again, someone, I guess Rory is a good example, competing so often, you almost can't help but mute the effect of a loss or a win, right?
Like
with
that
many matches.
Right.
How could you be that upset by an outcome?
Yeah, you start getting so much data that each experience is only one data point.
Yeah.
That puts you in a better place for sure. Yeah. So I think in anything in life, you know, I had one of my students come to me a while ago and he's sort of looking for general life advice. And my advice was just find something that you can develop yourself in. You know, he's like, well, I'm sort of interested in investing. I go, well, just try to learn about investing and become a better investor. So even if you don't make any money investing for the next 5 or 6 years or whatever period of time, if you improve your skill set in that, man, you're going to be in such a great place at the end of that, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like fail-safe advice. You know, if you're just developing yourself, you're just putting yourself in a better position for the future as opposed to trying to win everything today, right now.
Yeah.
So I'm still trying to do that. I'm still trying to focus on developing when I go to training and when I go to these competitions.
And also this idea of, I mean, as you know, it's getting tiresome because I've been thinking about this for so long now, but this idea of how to allocate your time in a productive way. I'm in this new phase of life where I'm like, I kind of get my kids squared away. I kind of got my finances squared away. You know, a lot of stuff is squared away. And I'm like, how should I spend my days? Mm. You know what I mean? Like this comes up with me all the time. Different with you, with other people, where it's like, how should I? What's an optimal way to spend my time? And that's related to what you're saying, right? You're like,
yes,
I want to do well in this competition, but is the optimal thing really to spend all my time preparing for it and training?
Yeah.
You know, like even if that gets you to the optimal place for the competition, it still might not be quite the right balance. Like, do you know what I mean? Like you could be like, I'm a notch, you know, some tiny notch down from where I could possibly be, but I'm enjoying my life more, you know?
I totally agree, Dan. Yeah, what are we optimizing for? Are we optimizing to win tournaments? That can't be correct for me, right? Can't be, right? That doesn't make any sense. Maybe if you're a young professional athlete, it might be that's what you should be doing. But even for them, at some point, they probably need to change what they're optimizing for, right?
Yeah. Or even like temporarily, like you, I forgot, one of the tournaments, maybe Worlds or something, you were like, I really want this and I'm willing to just optimize for that for, 6 months, 4 months, whatever it is.
Yep.
A year. I don't know. You're like, I'm willing to do that. You might be like, that makes me happiest.
Yes.
Spend all my time preparing for this to come in as good as I can.
Yes.
But then not every tournament, not every, you know.
And you know what, Dan? I've already got the medals that make me feel good enough about my performances that now they're just like a little redundant, you know? So I don't really need them. Yeah.
You might not want to be spending all your time just trying to chase more, right? Like, because that can get an endless cycle.
Very diminishing returns to it. Yeah. And I'm trying to move away from the whole status, pursuit of status anyways, which is, you know, what these medals are really about. They also do scoring, Dan. So you get so many points for during a year, how you perform. So I think in 2020, you know, it was a shortened year. I ended up coming in number 2 for Nogi in Master 6, Black Belt. I was like, oh, wow, I didn't even know it. And they sent me a little plaque or whatever. But I know there were some competitors who chase those points. Like, that's what makes them feel good. It's like they're optimizing to get as many points in that
scheme as possible. So you can get points if you're the only one that shows up in the division.
Yes.
And then you just go show up, grab points, and go home.
And any medals you get points for, too.
Right. And so then all you're doing is chasing points then. Like, you're optimizing your life for points instead of
for the points.
Other goals.
Which would not be what I would want to do at all. So, and like you said, then you don't want to lean into that. You don't want to celebrate that too much either if that's not what you're trying to optimize for. Definitely no. And guys do some shady things. Not shady, but they do some ridiculous things. Yeah.
Like purposely move into a weight class.
An empty bracket. Yeah. That's kind of crazy, right? But these things happen, you know? I've heard stories where people in the sort of the marathon circuit, seniors, were not running the race in order to somehow get some kind of result so they could get points and do well. You know, it's just crazy,
like,
right?
Like, sign up and then you get some points for...
I think you get points for your finishing, but some people would cheat. They would, like, take a cab or something, you know what I mean, in order just to get the points so they could say... For 80-year-olds, I'm the number one in the country or something, you know? It's just so crazy, right?
But again, think of the mistake to still have that mindset at 80 or 70 or whatever, you know, to actually be like at that point in your life and you're like, I'm still chasing points. But
I think that's what status does. It comes from an unconscious place. And if we're not consciously aware of it, it can have you doing some strange things, right? And feeling good and... probably feeling bad a lot too, I bet, right?
Yeah.
When you're leaning into that whole status game. Not enough of a win there, right? It's just not the way to live a life, I think. Yeah. But I think the way to deal with it is to be conscious of it. Like, this is what's happening, you know? I was thinking about that the other day. My son and I, we talk a lot about human nature. We talk about the science of personality, these things like that. And I was thinking, if I was going to educate a young person, I would advise them to learn about human nature, mostly through evolutionary psychology, not old school psychology, not Freud and Jung and all that stuff. Much of that is not great. So learn about how the human animal tends to work, and then learn about personality, learn about what your personality is. So then you can start to see like how you're going to tend to react in certain situations, and maybe you can lean one way or the other to sort of help you get the outcomes that you want. I think that would be a great foundation for an education, right? As early as possible, they can understand it, you know. So much stress comes into my life through people, right? And how they act. And usually they're just acting according to human nature and according to their own personality. And we're just coincidentally part of the play at that moment, you know. And if you knew enough about that, you'd go, oh, this person sort of seems to have this type of personality. And based on human nature, they're probably going to feel like this in this situation. And then you can predict it with better accuracy.
So lots of things. You could predict it. You might be able to better position to move the interactions in a direction that makes you happier, you know, like.
Right.
And then you might be faster or better able to come to a realization like, I don't mix well with this person.
Right. Exactly.
We're just not going to mix well.
Right.
We need to steer clear.
Right. So I know we talked about this before, but the science of personality currently talks about, they use an acronym, OCEAN, OCEAN. The O is openness. So most people that come train martial arts are, on average, more open than others. And all of these characteristics are sort of plotted on a bell curve across a population.
Do you mean they're open just because what kind of person walks in through that door to...
Yeah. I think they're way more likely to be above average in openness. Yeah. The C is conscientiousness, which is how hardworking you are and how orderly you are. I think I'm relatively hardworking, Dan. I think I'm maybe a little below average in orderliness, but the E is extroversion. Everybody sort of knows what that is, right? The A is for agreeability. So if somebody is above average agreeable, they're... Like, oh, where do you want to go for dinner? Whatever you want to do, you know. And then the disagreeable people, some of them, if they're highly disagreeable, they're never going to be happy, right?
You'd think the opposite of agreeable of your example would be like they have a specific place they want to go, but sometimes there's no place.
Oh, they'll go there and that place will suck. Yeah. They'll spend the whole time bad-mouthing that place. I've noticed it now when somebody comes to my academy and they've like, oh, I've trained at these six places, and there's no sort of geographical reason for them to be moving around. Like, they didn't move their home or anything, and all six of those places came up short for them. That means they're probably highly disagreeable. Right. And guess what? They're going to be moving on from your place, too.
They're not going to like your place.
They're not going to like your place either. So I've been, since I understand it, I can better see that coming. And it's not that I'm not welcoming to them, but I just expect them to be dissatisfied just because it's their personality. It has nothing to do with what we're doing, you know.
I was thinking there's more than one person within my family that I know that, like, part of going out to eat to a restaurant is, like, being really angry about something that happens. Like, at like, so just like a meal out, and something will happen every meal that has them, like, completely, like, what, you know, like, shocked by what something about what they said or how long it's taking.
Right.
A big one is how long it's taking, because then you can even like the meal, but it took too long.
Oh, my God, it took a long time.
Yeah, or, you know, something's off about the food, and they're sending it back, and it's like, I think they almost expect that's part of going out to eat. And I, you know, I think it's an example. You said it's disagreeable, because it doesn't matter where you are. Like, you can be, you know, one's a Chinese restaurant, kind of fast food. One's like a high-end kind of steak place. Like, it doesn't matter.
Right.
They'll have the same reaction.
They can find something to not like. Yeah. Oh, now the N in ocean stands for neuroticism, Dan. And I think most people aren't completely clear on what they mean in that acronym, but what they mean is emotional variability. Does somebody have a lot of high highs and low lows, or is somebody relatively flat? Those are the sort of the ends of the spectrum of neuroticism. And I've found that people that are highly emotionally variable, you know, they're going to cause you a little bit more headache maybe than other people, because if you combine that with disagreeability, now you get a great package there, right? But, you know, I was listening to this Dr. Lyle on his podcast where they talk about evolutionary psychology. And you probably know this, Dan. I wasn't totally clear on this, but they use the word distortion. So when a person, maybe he goes to see a psychologist because he's depressed, there's something wrong, and he goes to see, what do they call it? Cognitive behavioral therapist, CBT.
Yeah.
And basically, the way they explained it is that the therapist is trying to remove the distortion the person has in their life. So maybe they had a romantic breakup where they got dumped, and they're like, I'm never going to date another woman again in the rest of my life, and they're profoundly depressed. And then and that's a distortion. It's like, well, no, that's not reality. You're very likely going to date somebody else that you're probably going to have a good experience with. But in the moment, they're so emotionally wrought that it creates this distortion where they can't see reality. And then the therapy is basically getting them to see reality. And once they see reality, they're like, oh, that was a bummer that we broke up, but I'm probably going to find some. And then they feel better. So I've been thinking that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but highly emotional people, these emotionally variable people, I think they're more likely to have distortions than other people. What do you think? Does that sound reasonable?
Yes, but I think I was thinking of, you know, in terms of jiu-jitsu too, and how it definitely applies. And we've mentioned versions of it before, where, because there can be extreme versions, like I'll never date anyone again, or versus I'm a horrible person, no one will ever love me, you know, like, and then jiu-jitsu, we've said there's that. I remember talking to you about this years ago, that sort of continuum of a bad day of jiu-jitsu. There's that, you're always pushing to be on this side of the continuum of, like, what exactly went wrong and how do I fix it?
Technically.
Yeah. A step down from that is, like, my guard sucks. But, you know, like, you take, like, a broader, you know, like, my guard just sucks. Or then, like, down from that is, like, my jiu-jitsu sucks. All the way to, as you've pointed out, you can be like, I'm a terrible athlete. I suck.
I'll never be any good. Yeah.
And then all the way to, like, beyond jiu-jitsu, right? It's just like, I just suck. Everything I try, I just screw up.
Yeah, that's.
I think it happens, right? Like,
I think it can, unfortunately. So, yeah.
And there's that, but you see how there's that whole continuum, right? Where it's like, and you always push, like, all the way to, you know, you don't want to even be a little bit. You don't even want to be like, I'll never be good at, I'll never be able to pass, or, you know, something like that. Like, you don't even want to be one step down that. You want to be like, as much as possible, thinking, how do I just address this one thing and not run with it?
And a certain level of confidence can be very helpful in your development. If I think I'm trying to pass your guard, I'm like, there's no way in hell, it's impossible for me to pass your guard, then my nervous system is actually going to not let me try my hardest. It's going to like hold me back, and I'm not going to have the performance or even the development that I would otherwise have.
And don't you also think part of that, like what you've been pushing now, is this examining everything technically?
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, if I'm not thinking about that, like I never did, and I'm just trying to pass and trying to pass and trying to pass, and I can't, it's kind of reasonable to be like, I'll just never pass this guard. Like, you're getting more and more tired, and you're like, this is ridiculous. I can't pass it. I think one thing that could help is like, well, why can't I pass it?
Right.
Right? Like, what exactly is happening?
Right. Or even, what's one thing I can do to get a little bit closer to passing, if not even
or,
passing?
Or even, what's a mistake? I'm like, can I stop doing one thing?
Exactly.
Even if it doesn't make me closer at that moment, it's like, at least I'm not doing that. At least I'm not letting him grab my hand and sweep me. And
exactly.
You know, like,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
And then sometimes, though, also, I would say what puts me at a different spot than probably you and a bunch of other people, like, I also can't always tell. You know what I mean? It can be like, I don't know what to do to make this better. But that's what the gym is there for, right? Like, someone,
that's what the coach is there for.
Coaches are there for to
definitely
tell you.
Point you in the right direction, at least. Yeah, definitely. Well, Dan, that's about all I have. What do you think?
I think we should summarize the groundhog thing, because that's a good point. Like Bill Murray at the end of Groundhog.
At the end, where he's pure of heart, Dan. I know it's a fable, though it's fable language. And he's devoted himself to self-development. And once he finally does that, everything clicks. The spell's broken. He wins the girl, at least temporarily. Who knows? They probably broke up 18 months later or something. But hey, he's in a hell of a lot better place than he was. It's going to be way easier for him to get the next girl. He can play
and
all
we
that
should
piano
say that. That's the implication, right? Is that he's going to be happier going forward.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Well, actually, that's a good point, Dan. In the movie, he found some happiness even before he won her over, just because he's helping people. He's involved in this band, and people appreciate him, and he's developing, and that's where his happiness comes from. And then the romantic part of it is just the, you know, icing on the cake. It's just a little extra.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be, and when he leaves Punxsutawney, he's going to be happier still, you know, going forward.
Definitely, definitely.
It's a good point. I thought your point was just going to be like, what was it? Watch that first step. It's a doozy.
That's right.
This is also not bad
advice.
It's going
to be buy life insurance. Yeah. So now, is that an obvious point about this movie, about how he devoted himself purely to self-development? That is what the key was?
No, I don't think...
Not that obvious.
To word
right?
it, I mean, again, if you want to be snarky, people, you know, there's always someone that can be like, of course, we know what happened in Groundhog Day, but it's like, but if you kind of think, how does it apply to yourself, and how does it apply to jiu-jitsu? Like, I doubt that many people have done that, you know?
If I can apply myself to jiu-jitsu... To my develop, be pure of heart and like, I just want to develop my jiu-jitsu, I'm going to have a lot of great days of jiu-jitsu, and I'm going to get a lot better, and my performance is going to follow. So, yeah, that's what I'm going to try to do.
And again, you never know what image helps something stick. If someone's like, if they're like, yeah, I get, that's helping me think it through. That like Bill Murray at the beginning, Bill Murray at the end, that resonates with me. And some of people won't resonate with. What can I tell you?
Yeah. Watch some other movie from the
90s. We'll do another,
Awesome.
Yeah, next week we'll do Braveheart.
Definitely. Next week we're doing Braveheart.
How that applies to jiu-jitsu.
Awesome. All right, everybody. Please subscribe. We're just under 700 subscribers. Get us over 1,000. Tell your friends about it. And we'll talk to you soon. Take care.